all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Now, this is Bob Gould, and welcome to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 Talk Radio in the Garden Spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's right. That's our home base, and this is our home territory, and we're here with another great Veterans Radio program. Today, I have one of my special guests, and she has been on our program many times. One of our guests that get a lot of response from our listeners, and that's Dr. Rebecca Grant. That's right, Dr. Grant. She's going to be on in just a few more minutes. So what is it? It's Memorial Day 2015. Boy, you know, when I was a kid, and that was a while back, this was like in the early 50s, we sold, as the Boy Scout, Cub Scouts, we sold flags. And I mean, we sold out on Flag Day, on Memorial Day, on the, everybody had a flag. We had little flags, big flags. And I want to see that repeated. Now, we get a lot of tie the yellow ribbon around the tree and welcome back. And I think that's really great. And thank you for your service. And we are, by the way, from all, I can say this for all the veterans, we are honored ourselves to have served. But let's fly the flag. Fly the flag. Remember Iwo Jima, what it did to the soldiers, the Marines, when they saw the flag, the red, white, and blue. Fly the flag, folks, okay? It doesn't take much to go out and get one and put it there alongside your door, right there in the front of the house, or even a small one that you kind of stick in the ground. And here's one of our past guests that has a Revolution Flag Group. That's a company. This kid's a, and I say kid, anybody under 40 is a kid to me. But this young man, he's quite the person, and he's been doing this for about 4 years now. He's got his own little flag company. He was also responsible for having flags placed in Detroit, Michigan on the plaza when all the flagpoles had nothing on them, nothing. Absolutely no. Man, what do we need that for? Well, I'll tell you what we need it for. That's the honor of the veterans. So this young man, Mike Soviak, and his Revolution Flag Group donated the flags to put on the 50 flagpoles. He made that happen last year. So how can, and by the way, you can get your own flag. They have different, Mike has different models and different styles and different costs. That's revolutionflaggroup.com. And if you need that info at revolutionflaggroup.com or call 866-319-4798. Fly the flag, folks. Put it somewhere on your house so that it can be seen by your neighbors and it can be seen by all those who want to honor America, not just on them. I happen to fly my flag every day except for the day it rains or snows. So I fly the flag every day. RevolutionFlagGroup.com, 866-319-4798. This is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio, right here on Talk 1600 WAAM. We'll be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Don't go away. May is Military Appreciation Month. And this May, Conway Truckload is introducing True to the Troops, a new initiative to help military veterans find exciting career opportunities as professional drivers. Conway Truckload honors veterans and respects the values they stand for. After all, teamwork and dedication are values that have made Conway Truckload a leader in the transportation industry. For more information about driving opportunities at Conway Truckload, visit TrueToTheTroops.com or call 866-WORK-FOR-US. Thank you.
will peal with joy, hurrah, hurrah.
Yeah, when Johnny comes marching home, all the Johnnies in marching home, all of us that have served. And by the way, you don't have to be in a war. I think it's less than 6%, 7% of all the military people have actually been in a war. Something like that, 10%. Maybe Dale knows. He's not here right now. He's on another assignment. And maybe, well, if he happens to be hearing this, listening, and give us a call and let us know. What is that percentage? But right now, I have with me as my guest, and always, always welcome, and I can just about turn over the mic to her, and I want to thank her again for coming on the program. I hope she's got a pot of tea, and it's a real marathon, folks, to have 45 minutes on the air. Whew. Anyway, Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS Independent Research. That's a public policy research organization. It's located in Washington, D.C. She's also director of the Washington Security Forum. That's a nonprofit. It was founded in 2012. It encourages research and discussion on how national security connects to advanced science and technology topics. That includes cyberspace, air power, space itself, and energy resources. Dr. Grant earned her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics. Hello. I think, we'll go out there and have a spot of tea. That's right. Then work for RAND. Ooh, those guys do a whole lot. That's a big think tank. Officer and offices of the Secretary of the Air Force and Chief of Staff of the Air Force. It was 1995 she founded IRIS. I want to make sure I get that right. That's Independent Research and Performing Work on Strategic Planning for Aerospace and Government Clients. Anyway, everything that you want to know, and you don't know where to, you can't always find it on the Internet, but you can find it on Veterans Radio because we have Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Bob, I'm delighted to be on the show.
I looked at all the things that I wanted to talk about, and it's almost like you can't even come up with a question. There's so much, so much going on right now in the world. We're just going to be touching on some of this, folks. So let's go ahead with China. China. There was a recent Pentagon report. It's an annual report to Congress that discusses China's their military and security strategy, technological advances, its capabilities, military doctrine, security issues in the Taiwan Strait. Let's start with that, security issues in the Taiwan Strait. Dr. Grant, tell us about that.
China, wow, it's the Taiwan Strait, Bob, absolutely, and it's more than that when you think of how big that Chinese coastline is. And the issue today is that China has for the past few years been attempting to expand their areas of influence. So there are a lot of little rocky outcroppings and offshore islands, disputed maritime territory, and they're bumping into just about everybody else who's out in that region, whether it's the Vietnamese, Philippines, Japan. They recently exchanged heated words with one of our maritime surveillance P-8 aircraft operating out of the Philippines. So a lot going on. Congress, several years ago now, asked the Pentagon to every year put together a report on China's military power. It used to be nobody really read this report very often, but now this has become must-read in Washington, D.C. What's interesting to me is a new report is pretty blunt about the rise of China, and it specifically says that Chinese military power is now approaching the point where it has, quote, the possibility to reduce core U.S. military technological advantages. I don't know about you, Bob. To me, that says they're catching up fast. They are catching up fast.
Well, okay. I don't know. Of course, I want to say, well, what are we doing about it? I mean, and that's what begs that question. But what about their development in space and cyber capabilities? The idea that I read somewhere the other day that they have or it's been alleged that they have the capability to shoot down drones. Tell us all about cyber and space and shooting down drones.
Right. They do have that capability to shoot down drones. They have the capability to shoot down all sorts of things. Well, remember, they shot down one of their own satellites back in 2007, and this really got everyone's attention because they had to do a very precise shot. They also exploded a lot of debris into the orbit there that is a danger to other satellites. They can do that. They have a very sophisticated air defense system, so the surface-to-air missiles. What's a little bit unique about China is not only do they have land-based surface-to-air missiles that can target a drone or an aircraft, but they have for several years now put these missiles onto their Navy ships. That's the capability we have as well, but for China to be able to do this means they can essentially expand that air defense network, not just along the coast, but right out into these areas where we have the maritime territorial disputes. So whether it's down around the South China Sea, around in the area of the Philippines, or if it's up north in the East China Sea off Japan, they have an ability now to really challenge for control of the airspace if they want to do that. That's a pretty scary new capability, something we haven't seen elsewhere in the world. And for China to have that means that they are able to expand their area of operations and their influence out quite a bit further than they used to be able to do.
What's their point? What the heck are they doing? What's their point?
Well, their last leader, Hu Jintao, talked about peaceful rise. But their current leader, and he's in the middle of his 10-year term, Xi Jinping, says, great power. China is ready to be a military great power to go with the economic stature they have in the world. And so that means they are making a much bigger fuss about areas that they want to claim. So no question. And they've backed this up with some kind of interesting military reforms. They're doing some things that would make a lot of sense. They are reducing the size of their army a little bit, increasing their navy, increasing their aviation, increasing special forces and their cyber branch. They also want to have a different ratio, have more enlisted to officers, which, as we know, if they're serious, they're going to have more enlisted folks, right, who actually do the work. So they're doing some changes. They have a reform plan in place to change into a much more professional, assertive force by 2020. And we see them training for that as well. They fly now at night. They fly out over the water. They challenge Japan's air self-defense force aircraft. They challenge our U.S. Navy aircraft, U.S. Air Force aircraft. They're doing much, much more than they did 10 years ago. So becoming a very active, practiced force as well as technology leaders, too. So they're really closing in on what used to be our very, very great advantage. They are really narrowing that gap quite a lot.
Well, I'm not sure what it is that they, is it expansionism that they want? Is it respect that they want? What is your take on what? I know that they're working on building up the middle class. But do they even have enough money to do all this? And one other thing, they just added an aircraft carrier, their first aircraft carrier. Tell us all about all that.
Right. They added one aircraft carrier. They plan to build between 2 and 5 more. And that's so that they can expand the air cover out. You asked, what is it they really want? Well, they've talked about wanting to extend out past what they call the first island chain so that their influence doesn't stop at international waters but goes right out several hundred miles from the coast out in through the Pacific. So they want to be a great power. They want to be treated as a great power. I think some of this motivation is internally focused, but a lot of it is to give them the stature in the world that they believe they've earned. They're doing some other things, too, that go with great power status that are good things. They are participating more in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, doing quite a lot of things to try to show the flag in that manner. But on the whole, their stance in their own theater is very much that they don't want the U.S. and our treaty partner allies to be able to rule the roost around the Pacific as we've done for many, many years, which we do, of course, in order to maintain the global commons, maintain sea trade, keep the airlines open as well. China has now said they want to have much more of a military presence in those areas, and that is what they're doing. They have done something very interesting. Have you heard of the Fiery Cross Reef Project?
No.
Well, that is a funny name, but what they've done is they've taken some very rocky, very small islands that are actually underwater most of the time. They've brought in landfill and created a 10,000-foot runway where basically there was just seawater over some rocky shoals. So you look at this and you think, why would they want to do that? I don't think it's going to be a tourist spot. That is clearly to be a staging area for large aircraft, whether those are surveillance aircraft or strike aircraft. That Fiery Cross Reef, to me, is a very clear sign of China wanting to expand its basing and its reach in the Pacific.
Well, just one quick, is that aircraft carrier that they built, is that nuclear?
No, it's conventionally powered. It was a ship built by the old Soviet Union and brought through the Black Sea. In fact, the Turks said if they'd known what the Chinese wanted to do with that, they never would have let it through the Bosphorus. But it came through many years ago, and the Chinese have since rehabilitated the ship. They bought it and said they wanted to make it a floating casino, but that's not what they did. They put an anti-skid coating on it, revamped it, and it is now an operational aircraft carrier.
Let's get the there's so many areas I want to go with in the direction of China, and as a friend of mine who happens to be a consultant to Chinese studies was talking about, because they have so many workers, if they wanted to, they could take over the world as far as production. They have a billion people, right? Billion workers, billion and a half. And I'm just, where is this all, where does the Air Force, where does the military see this all going in the next decade?
Well, that's a great question. You know, what do we expect in the next decade? Because typically with China, they'll be assertive and then back off a little bit and then come roaring out again, which is what we've seen in this case. I think the most important thing for our strategy is we want to maintain our close ties with our allies in that region, whether that's Australia, the Philippines, Japan, of course, and many, many others, because we don't want those close allies to turn to China for their security. So we want to maintain our alliances, and that requires maintaining military forces in the region. So that's why we see quite a bit of the Navy, of course, deployed to the Pacific. The Marines have started exercising in Australia on a more regular basis. They've always gone through there, but they're there more often. We've seen Air Force deployments to Australia as well, and all this is part of signaling to China that the U.S. is a Pacific nation, and we're serious about providing for the security in that area. Another kind of low-level but important thing going on is our commanders in the Pacific are trying to work with their Chinese counterparts on some basic safety measures. So when ships approach, here's what we do. When aircraft come close to each other in the sky, here's what we do. We try to have a safe encounter. I think they've made some progress there. But the larger thing is we are trying to regain some of the ground and our technological advantage so that we don't fall behind. You know, we know China's a great power. We will trade with them, but we need to be able to deter from a position of strength. And that means maintaining our top-level forces and buying some new forces as well for the Pacific and keeping our deployments there top-notch.
I like hearing all that. I like hearing every bit of that. Tell us about it. The Chinese still launching cyber attacks in the Department of Defense.
Oh, I think so. And you know, it's not just the Pentagon that's of interest. They really have pressed pretty hard on American industry, and not just the big companies that you think of, the Boeings and Lockheed Martins. They'll go after the smaller companies that work with the big industry companies and try to get in any way they can. So everybody keep your virus software up to date, report any funny encounters. The cyber threat is really there. And China is very persistent in that. They would deny it, but I think we have seeing for sure that China really is persisting in its cyber warfare.
Do you think that China has been more open as to its military strategy?
You know, they have, in a way. I mean, they've talked about wanting to rise and become a great power. They've talked about an information-based strategy. So we know that their military is designed to wage short, sharp wars, very high-intensity conflict, but short duration. They've talked about wanting to gain superiority and close the gap with U.S. and allied forces in the region. So it's not that much of a mystery. Now, what their intent is behind it and how the strategy mixes with the politics, that's a bit less clear. But their military writers, their generals and academicians, have been quite blunt about wanting to become a true great power and act that way.
Now, we have about 5 minutes before we go for the halfway break. In your opinion, and I know that you get access to a lot of information that we will never hear about or couldn't find, even on Google or the internet. What would you do if you were somebody that was in the place of power with the U.S.? What would you do?
As regards to China, you have to do two or three things with China. One is continue to have that military dialogue. But secondly, and I think the most important thing, is to show strength and show our coherent strategy in the region. We want to keep deploying our top-notch aircraft carriers to that region. We want to maintain the conventional bomber presence that we fly from Guam on a regular basis. We keep B-52s and occasionally B-2s there as well to fly all around the Pacific region and show our strength. That was how we were able to fly a bomber up into the disputed air defense zone over a year ago. And that's how, of course, the B-2s flew across Korea as well, sending a signal down there in North Korea. So we need to make sure that we have our top-notch forces in the Pacific. We have to maintain a strong deterrent posture in the Pacific. And I think the Chinese will respect us more and be more cautious in their long-term strategy if we do that. If we don't maintain top-level forces in the Pacific, you know, that would make me very uncomfortable. We know how big and how quickly growing China's economy is. And I think it's natural. It's this point in history where China does rise to become a major power, but we want to be able to balance that, both with our economy and with our military forces. It's that balance is essential, but we cannot let the military piece of that crumble. It's got to stay strong.
So it's kind of like guns and butter.
It is. We need both guns and butter in this relationship. That's how, you know, in the old economics classes like you took in college, Bob, it was the question, do you want to have guns or butter? In the U.S.-China relationship, it's got to be both guns and butter to make it work well.
And where do you see, what is the Chinese? We have about 2.5 minutes before the break. What is the Chinese economy? What are they making money on? They've got so much of their population are peasants, and are they contributing to the national economy? How are they getting the money to pay for all this, Dr. Grant?
Well, they are very productive, and China's economy and society has changed, too. There really is a strong and growing middle class in China, and they want what all of us middle class folks on planet Earth want. They want the consumer goods, you know, the carpet, the nice food at the supermarkets, all this. So we do see the desire for that, cars. You read a lot about the air pollution issues in China, part of that caused by the increasing consumer society. In a lot of ways, I think that's a very positive development because it gives middle-class China a stake in things. Life is getting pretty good for them, and they want to keep it that way. But it also unleashes some difficult forces. They have to continue to grow the economy, as we found. One thing very related to the military, you know, the military in China engages in trade, and they actually build and sell arms and other things. They own property and do all kinds of things our services don't do. And they've had some big corruption scandals in the military, but they're trying to tamp those down. So I think that's a sign, too, that's pretty positive in terms of reform. But there's no question China is a growing power, a growing middle class. And although it's an aging society, and of course with their one-child policy that's been in play for many decades, that gives them some demographic concerns that will affect their security policy over time, perhaps. But we see a pretty powerful rising nation there, and I think they want to gain the respect on the world stage and do that with their military forces as well as with their trade and economy.
Well, we'll be right back. We're coming up on our halfway point, and Dr. Graham, please have yourself a little bit of tea and rest your voice. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 WAAM.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Hear that one, George M. Cohen, over there. And every time I, Dr. Grant, whenever I look at a map, open up a newspaper, magazine, we're all over the world. Over there is everywhere. And right now, folks, I don't know about you, but I am so confused with the ISIL airstrikes. Shiites, Sunnis, and ground that we fought for in 2003, 2002, 2004 is being taken back. Dr. Grant, what is with ISIS, ISIS, and let's start with airstrikes. Now, this is part of a coalition movement. Airstrikes, are all the pilots part of this coalition that was put together? Are the American pilots, what planes are they using, and what kind of effect have they had? Go ahead.
Right. So, yes, it's an American-led coalition under the command of the current Air Force's component commander there, who's Lieutenant General John Hesterman. John Hesterman is a F-117 pilot, flew in Operation Desert Storm many years ago, since flown the F-15. There's really no one better to understand that region and run that air campaign. He's doing a great job. It's an allied group. We have both U.S. Air Force, obviously, Navy, Marine Corps, and then a number of allies and partners, including the British, the Australians, and then some partners that we haven't always had before, from the Gulf Cooperation Council states, partners like the UAE, and many, many others, Italians, the Dutch, on and on. They really rotate through there, and they've been a very, very good force. Now, the trouble is, I don't know, Bob, that all the air power in the world can help an Iraqi army decide to stay in a city. You know, we heard Secretary of Defense Ash Carter this week making some strong statements after the Iraqis evacuated the city of Ramadi, city we all learned the name of back when our forces were there some years ago, as you mentioned. So it's very tough. Now, General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, gave us a bit of a different perspective, explaining that the Iraqi ground forces had chosen to leave Ramadi for a more defensible position. But like you, I'm scratching my head and saying, you know, what does it take? What is the secret to success there? Because we seem not to have found it yet.
We're having these airstrikes. I see these wonderful weapons that we have, smart bombs, smart pilots, great aircraft, and yet we're not as effective as I would that I would expect. So these airstrikes, even though they were constant, there were dozens of them per day in Ramadi, they still were overrun. What about those airstrikes and the use of drones against ISIS? Go ahead.
Right. So I think the airstrikes, judged on just the tactical criteria, they are very effective. Some of the planes involved, the A-10, the F-15, the ever-useful F-16, and many others as well. All of these aircraft are flown by very experienced air crews. All these pilots, and in some cases you have a weapon systems operator, all the pilots have been there before. They know this kind of work. They're experts at it, both men and women. They're very precise. Every target is considered very carefully so that there isn't collateral damage. The thing that's really changed in the last couple decades, of course, is the terrific connection with the ground forces. So the ground forces, who the air controllers on the ground, can literally look at a little video picture on a device about the size of your iPhone, and the pilots in the cockpit see the exact same picture. So it's a terrific system that's enabled them to be very precise. So when they find a target, they're able to hit it and be very effective. The question, though, in that urban environment is what sort of targets need to be hit, and what kind of targets are going to allow the ground force there, which is obviously Iraqi ground forces, what's going to give them the desire to hold that ground? Or perhaps, as General Martin Dempsey suggested, this was part of an organized retreat. So there's a lot more here than the critique of the fire support. The fire support by the air component is excellent. The problem really is on the ground and with finding a strategy that will stand up against the Islamic State forces.
So we have folks on one of the criticisms, and I didn't think it was accurate because we've had somebody on this program that was a ground support, I forget the name, but I'll call it a ground support person that can actually call in the air strikes. And we had this, I think it was a captain or major. And are you saying that that's still in effect, that we have people also on the ground that are calling in these airstrikes to make them more accurate? Is that
true? Right, we have that ability, and the term you're looking for is the JTAC, the Joint Tactical Air Controller. So not only do we have U.S. Airmen who are JTACs, but we've trained a lot of allies to do this job as well. They get a lot of training to do it. So they are able to be as precise as they want and to call in the strike. We've certainly provided plenty of air power. It's not a case where there are controllers on the ground saying, bring me an airstrike, and there's no one available. That's not the case at all. They provided a lot of on-call, on-demand, push, cast, close air support for this battle. But it's just been a case, I think, all along with Operation Inherent Resolve, the air power piece of this, that they can hit the targets they find, but it's almost as though they can't generate enough targets to really make the difference. If the Islamic State forces aren't out in the open, if their scheme of maneuver isn't that apparent, you know, you can bring the air power where they want it, but if the ground forces aren't, for whatever reason, able to hold, then all the air power in the world, and they have all they need, all they could want, they have, isn't going to be enough to make the difference. Very frustrating. And it's not something we have seen. You know, we've seen the reverse with our U.S.-led and coalition forces, that they're able to be very effective with the same level of air power. We saw that in Iraq. We saw that in Afghanistan. It's just not what we're seeing this time. And like you, I found it very disappointing, very concerning.
Who, when there's going to be a call for an airstrike, how far up the chain of command does it have to go before it gets the final approval? I'm sure it doesn't always go to the Secretary of Defense. And how far up the chain of command to the local commander, or where does that all stand?
Right, sometimes not very far at all. So if it's what they have often called a troops in contact situation, friendly forces are taking fire and requesting an airstrike, and if the conflict is happening, you know, particularly in an area that has been, you know, the Army, you're in the Army, they like to draw their lines on the battlefield there, and within certain areas, they are clear to be able to handle this really from the controller directly to the pilot. Now the Air Operations Center will be aware of what's going on, if not immediately, then shortly thereafter. But it's handled in a tactical way from that captain or major that you had on to the pilots in the cockpit. If it's a big fixed strike on an important building in the town that's next to some areas where there's concerns for hitting civilians, that may go back to the Air Operations Center in some cases. But in other cases, the controllers, who are very well trained, are authorized to go ahead and call in the strikes, particularly for that Type 1 CAS. They're able to do that on their visual reconnaissance.
Recently, there was the killing of one of the ISIS head muckety-mucks there that I couldn't tell you the dude's name at this point, but he was killed, and I understand it was by a drone strike. What are the drones doing? And what is this whole drone situation over there against the ISIS, and what about the comment on, I'd like you to comment on drones and their systems, including the UN talking about banning them. What do you think about all that?
Right, that's such an interesting question, and the UN's discussion of bans on autonomous weapons. Well, we've had the drones or the unmanned aircraft there, several different types, for a pretty long time. Their number one job is to provide intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And this is done with some drones that are very small and hand-launched, and others that are huge, like the Global Hawk, which is able to fly transcontinental missions and to stay out for many, many hours. It's a high-altitude drone. Then the ones that we're very familiar with as well, the Army's Gray Eagles, the Air Force's Reapers. Those drones not only have sensors on them, electro-optical sensors, some cases infrared, synthetic aperture radar, which can take pictures through weather and haze, and other types of sensors that pick up electronic signals. So their main purpose is to give air and ground commanders a sense of what the enemy forces are doing, whether that's by picture or full motion video or something else. Some of the drones are also armed, and in that case, like the Reaper, they become almost like a fighter. So as they start to track a high-value target like this Islamic State leader you talked about, it really comes down to which is the aircraft that's closest to be able to take the strike when they have absolutely confirmed that the target is the right one that they're looking for. So sometimes that will be an F-16 or an F-18. Oftentimes, though, it will be, for example, that Reaper unmanned aircraft that's there and may launch something like a Hellfire missile or other type of relatively small weapon if they're targeting, say, a terrorist who is in a car or a vehicle moving along a road. That's often how they'll conduct that strike. It takes really a lot of surveillance and usually is the product of many, many days, at least, of work to make a strike like that happen.
But they're effective, right?
Oh, yes, they are.
Thank
very
you.
Effective.
And there's,
they're very effective.
Here's to all the critics on that. I mean, let's listen to somebody that's close to the truth here. They are effective. They do what they're supposed to do. And there's enough of them out there. Now, the UN wants to ban them. How close is that coming?
They're talking about it, and what they want to ban also is potential autonomous weapons. But we have to remember, these drones are controlled by human crew members. And they are part of the larger scheme of command. You know, the drones don't go to theater on their own. They don't get maintained by themselves. And someone puts the bombs on them, right? So these are not like killer robots that are out wandering around on their own. Not at all. So I think that they're very effective. And I remember a special operations commander who I talked to once said, you know, what do you want us to do when we find that real bad guy? Do you want me to send in 20 guys in a helicopter or 20 guys in vans and trucks to go pick him up off the street? Or can we just use the drone strike? You know, I mean, that's the kind of stark choice that those men and women involved in this face. And so that's why, you know, me sitting back here, I have to say, hey, those drone strikes can be very effective. And it's a tool that our forces use. They use it carefully. They use it well. And I want to see them to continue to have the tools they need to do the missions that we ask them.
Take a deep breath. Have a sip of tea with a little lemon in it. We're going to be right back to hear from Conway Freight, both Conway Freight and Legal Help for Veterans. Derek, can we do all that, right? He's shaking his head. Okay, we'll be right back after these very important messages. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Wham! Talk 1600. May is Military Appreciation Month, and this May, Conway Truckload is introducing True to the Troops, a new initiative to help military veterans find exciting career opportunities as professional drivers. Conway Truckload honors veterans and respects the values they stand for. After all, teamwork and dedication are values that have made Conway Truckload a leader in the transportation industry. For more information about driving opportunities at Conway Truckload, visit TrueToTheTroops.com or call 866-WORK-FOR-US.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Yeah, I think the drummer stopped by the PX before he started drum. But anyway, that was, of course, Yankee Doodle Dandy on this Memorial Day, 2015. I want to ask you one more question, Dr. Graham, before we get on to another topic. It calls into question the Obama administration's hopes that they rely solely on airstrikes to support the Iraqi forces in expelling extremists. Tell us about that.
Well, I see, yes, that's right, to rely on airstrikes. But I think we have to remember that along with the airstrikes come the air controllers that we were talking about before the break. So we have seen advisors go over. You know, they haven't said exactly who these advisors are, but it would be my guess that among these advisors are the types of air controllers who can make these strikes very effective. So I think they've done a pretty good job in providing the type of air power that's needed. And they certainly haven't held back on being able to provide top-of-the-line aircraft, great maintainers, and the right weapons. And then most of all, of course, this day and night oversight, the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance that is so crucial to how this is done. So we have great ISR. We have a great eyes on the battle space, the ability to attack, the ability to use the airstrikes. But that's where the limit has been set, and I think there's international agreement on that as well. I think we would not see a great international backing for the type of offensive that we saw 10 years ago. So it's up to air power to do it, as that's kind of the international response right now. We've wanted to keep that response within the bounds of the international coalition, and so I think they've done the best they can do with this, no question.
Well, you talked about air power, and this is called a segue, folks, because there has been competition that began a few years back when there were some folks that were saying, we don't need a long-range bomber. We're not going to put the money into that. That's all been changed. The next generation bomber, NGB, is, and by the way, folks, you listen to Veterans Radio, you get all this nice secret information. Yeah, you get the scoop right here. Well, Dr. Grant, tell us about the NGB that's coming up.
The next bomber. So by sometime this summer, sometime before Labor Day, we don't know exactly when, because right now there is a Pentagon team that is closeted and reviewing two different aircraft. One of them will be picked as the winner of the long-range bomber competition. It's a $55 billion contract. Over time, they expect to have a new bomber, a new stealth bomber, out on the runways by about the middle of the next decade, so about 2025. And we'll have an announcement from the Air Force sometime this summer as to who the winner is. We have two really terrific teams competing. One is Northrop Grumman, who made the B-2 bomber. They also make E-2 naval radar plane with the dish on top. They're the great house. Grumman, of course, is a terrific name that goes back into World War II. You think about the terrific Grumman Avengers and all the different aircraft they've made. So Northrop Grumman is one of the contenders. The other one, perhaps an even more impressive team, is Boeing and Lockheed Martin together have teamed up to submit a design for the new long-range strike bomber. And they're a great pair because Boeing has a tremendous production line expertise and the latest commercial techniques from their airline business. Lockheed Martin, of course, are the leaders in designing stealth aircraft. They make the F-35. They made the F-22. They have that great Skunk Works operation out in Palmdale that made the SR-71 and is the U-2 and such a famous outfit. So they've teamed up. So I imagine that the two together have put in some pretty interesting designs. Now, the Air Force has chosen to run it as what they call a black program. Do you know what a black program is, Bob?
No, I have no idea.
A black program is a program you're not supposed to see at all, so it's completely secret. We know it exists. But we don't know much about the funding. We don't know much about what's going on with it. It is completely secret. We don't know if they're looking at paper designs or if they've had demonstrators. Some of the aviation journalists have speculated that there have been some flights of prototype bomber aircraft, but we have no idea. So the Air Force has chosen to keep it in the black because of the extremely sophisticated technologies that we expect this bomber to have. So what's so interesting about this is they will make this announcement in the summer, and I imagine they'll reveal to us not only who the winner is, but a little bit about what this bomber looks like. Is it real long range? Is it an intermediate bomber? We know it will have a really stealthy look to it, but we should know, as I say, within this summer who the winner is of this next bomber competition. We haven't made a new bomber here in the U.S. since the B-2 rolled out in 1989, and that contract was awarded in 1981. That's a long, long time ago. This is the first one since then. Very exciting time.
Okay, the NGB, right, the long-range bomber. But we were just talking about short strikes in the city of Ramadi, and that's not long-range. What is the military strategy? Tell us, is this going to be the same fail-safe where they're flying overhead, there's always going to be a fleet of them ready to... Are we going back to that again? What is the purpose of a long-range bomber?
Right. Well, what is the role for this long-range bomber? Well, it's got several. One is that global mission that you talked about, and you know we never really left that, because the bombers do remain an important part of the nuclear deterrence triad. So this new bomber will eventually take on a nuclear deterrence mission itself. We'll see eventually the retirement of the B-52. Hard to imagine, but that will happen.
And when?
It's a great plane, but time for it to go.
When is that scheduled?
It is not scheduled. It is absolutely not scheduled, but as this new bomber comes along in the right numbers, I think we'll begin to see some retirements of B-52s. You know, many of them have been retired, but the ones that remain will begin to see some incremental retirements, perhaps in the next decade. Eventually we'll see the B-2 retire, but that may be even further out. The first one to retire might be the B-1. We may see pieces of that go, but this new bomber will have a nuclear deterrence mission. Equally important, it will have a conventional deterrence mission. So its ability to conduct precise conventional strikes against any type of targets, a buried underground nuclear weapons facility, call this long-range bomber, a communication center, call this long-range bomber, forces moving, maybe with armor, a country attacking a neighbor, call this long-range bomber. Now, what about supporting troops? Absolutely. We saw the B-52 do that, of course, in Vietnam. We've seen all the bombers support ground operations in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So the bombers are also very good because they carry such a heavy payload. Those joint tactical air controllers can ask for strikes from bombers as well. This is done on a daily basis almost in Afghanistan, where the B-1 carries out that mission. This new bomber will also have that mission too, and be able to do it where there are heavy surface-to-air missile defenses and enemy fighters. So it'll be there for the ground forces as well as for that global long-range deterrence mission.
We're coming up to the last minute, and I'd like, as the last comment, I'd like to leave that to you. Was there something that you'd like to say regarding Memorial Day to all of our listeners?
Oh, I would, and that is to thank everyone for their service. Living here in Washington, D.C., we celebrate Memorial Day. We see the flags at Arlington, and they remind us of the sacrifices that so many generations have made to give us this wonderful country, best country in the world. And thank you to all of you veterans and to those who sacrificed their lives for Memorial Day.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grant. Would you come back again?
Thank you, Bob. I love being on your show. I hope I do get to come back. Yes.
You have a blessed day. This is Bob Gould saying once again, for Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.